I'm very happy now to welcome Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of the new book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. And he will be speaking tonight, Monday, May 24th at 6 o'clock at the School for Advanced Research. It's a benefit for them, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So the Battle of Little Bighorn, very famous battle between the U.S. Army led by George Armstrong Custer and the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne led by Sitting Bull. It has to be one of the most written about and mythologized battles in U.S. history. Why was it so mythologized, and why was it so important?
Well, you know, I think for one reason, it had a lot to do with George Armstrong Custer. He was a lightning rod of a general, actually Lieutenant Colonel during this battle, and you either loved him or hated him. He was a media sensation even before the battle, and then when he lost so completely, he's sort of known as history's greatest loser in many ways, and the fact that everyone under his specific command, his battalion, was killed, this meant that it's just a spectacular defeat, and because no one will ever know exactly what Custer was thinking, what was going on, since there were no survivors from his command, there'll always be this mystery hovering over it. And the other factor is that Custer's timing was exquisite. His portion of the battle was fought on June 25th, 1876, and just a little more than a month later, the country celebrates the centennial of its glorious birth, and it wasn't until July 7th, just 3 days later, that America learned that it's one of its most visible Indian fighters had suffered this tremendous defeat. And it was one of these things that just sent the country reeling, people asking, how could this ever happen? And we've been sort of asking that ever since.
One of the details that you talk about in the book, was that when Custer's body was found, he was smiling. And the mystery of the smile is one that in some way can never be solved. But what did you make of that?
Well, you know, I talk about it as being one of those great, sort of an enigma upon an enigma. You know, what the heck was, what? You know, his body was found, one of the few that wasn't horribly mutilated, although turns out he had suffered some mutilations that weren't necessarily talked about at the time. But, you know, here he was on this battlefield with, according to several accounts, a smile on his lips. So, you know, I talk about some of the possibilities, you know, but of course, so like so much of this battle, we'll never know for sure. And it's this mystery that makes it so powerful. I think, you know, one of the things, though, is we wouldn't be talking about Custer, and Custer was a man who would be very happy to know that we're talking about him 134 years later. And one of the reasons we're talking about him is because he died in this fashion. He went down in Bon Jovi's blaze of glory. And, you know, maybe he's smiling because he saw that. One of the things I bring out in my book is that his best friend in life was a Shakespearean actor named Lawrence Barrett, who in the months prior to the battle starred in a lavish production of Julius Caesar as Cassius. And Custer and his wife Libby went to New York to see this performance, and they saw it no less than 40 times. And if you read Julius Caesar with an eye out towards what's going to happen at the Battle of Little Bighorn, it's very suggestive, particularly given that Cassius's friend Brutus, both of them end up losing a battle at the end of the play and decide they have to fall on their own swords, and not until before Brutus says, I shall have glory by this losing day. So perhaps there was a little bit of Shakespeare inside Custer's head when he finally died. Who knows?
It's such a strange thing to think about. I was thinking, just wondering how strange it is that somebody, first of all, saw Julius Caesar 40 times, but that somehow these themes that just go from generation to generation and century to century repeat themselves. Tell us more about what Custer was like, how he got to be this famous Indian fighter, what his character was like.
Yeah, well, you know, before he went west, he was a Civil War general, and he had finished last in his class at West Point, but 2 years later was a brigadier general and would advance to major general before the war was over. He was a spectacular success in the Civil War. But the Western wars were different. sort of like going from our World War II to Vietnam, you know, from the good to the not-so-good war. And, you know, it was different out west because a victory often required you to attack a village of non-combatants. And so Custer romanticized his role as a fighter. In the Civil War, he wrote to a friend, you know, if I could have a battle every day, I'd be a happy man. And when he went to the West, he did the same thing. He tricked himself out in buckskin. He wore the red tie he had fashioned for himself in the Civil War. He had a pack of English greyhounds that surrounded him. And, you know, he's been called the Cavalier in buckskin. And, you know, he really played a role. I think his friend Lawrence Barrett, the Shakespearean actor, probably helped him in this regard. And, you know, he was consciously playing a role and romanticizing himself and making, you know, carving himself as the great American hero of the Wild West. And it's just amazing what kind of hold that has had on the American public.
And long after he died, his wife, who he was very romantically, deeply, intensely involved with, continued basically a PR campaign on his behalf.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he and Libby had this relationship that both of them idealized, but that did not prevent Custer from fooling around. But, you know, like many power couples before and since, they were devoted to his fame, and that's what really mattered. And when he died, she was the spin doctor, bar none. I mean, she would stand at the gates of his reputation and insist that he be remembered as she wanted him to be remembered. She would write three books. They're quite good books, actually, about their lives together in the West. And she would live into the 1930s, you know, so that she kept his name in lights in the way she wanted them to be well into the first half of the 20th century. It wouldn't be until after her death that the first book that began to really deconstruct Custer's personality in any significant way, The Glory Hunter, came out. And now, of course, I mean, I got onto Custer with Little Big Man, and by that time in 1970, you know, his reputation had changed by 180 degrees.
It is amazing that you took on a subject which has been so written about. What led you to do that?
Well, you know, my previous book was Mayflower, the sort of the event that we look to as the iconic beginning of America. A subject we're taught in third grade, but, you know, what the heck do we know about it? And one of the arguments with that book is the story of the Pilgrims doesn't end with the first Thanksgiving. I take it through King Philip's War, which was fought 50 years after the Pilgrims' arrival by their children and grandchildren, and it was just a terrible Native English conflict. And after writing that book, I thought, okay, so this is sort of the iconic beginning. Where does it lead? Well, it leads ultimately into America's push west and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And I had been fascinated with this topic ever since seeing Little Big Man back when I was a freshman in high school. And so I thought I'd go for it. You know, my previous books have been about the sea and you know, the watery wilderness, and I wanted to take it west and trace whatever continuities I could find and compare them. And it's funny. It's, at least for me, it's felt more like a culmination than a departure.
And there are metaphors of seafaring and water and the ocean that come in, perhaps because of the work you've done before. It was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've spent a lot of the last 4 years out there, and I get a very oceanic sense of vastness when I'm out there on the plains.
We're talking to Nathaniel Philbrick, author of the book The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. So let's talk about Sitting Bull. He was also a very unusual character, as you describe him, both brave and wise. What was he like?
Well, he was what his people needed at that extraordinary time in their history. With the encroachment of the whites, it was the Lakota were beset by all sorts of issues that had never been part of their world up until then. And it was decided by many leading members of the tribe that they really needed someone to coordinate their activities. And this did not necessarily come naturally to the people who really operated on consensual ways. But they looked to Sitting Bull, who had incredible charisma, political savvy. I mean, he was always working between different groups within his tribe that were not all necessarily on the same page, and great visionary power. Just a week before the battle, during a Lakota sun dance on the Rosebud River, he would have a vision of soldiers upside down falling into a Lakota camp, and this was seen as a sign of a great victory to come, which of course it would be. And so, I mean, he really provided the leadership and judgment and charismatic focus that enabled them to get through this very difficult period and ultimately allow them to win this great victory.
And he unified the Lakota and the Cheyenne people.
Right. And you know, and that was an alliance that was very late-breaking in terms of the politics of the Plains. But, you know, we think of the Old West as sort of written in stone, and, that way a kind of artifact. But things were changing constantly. It was very dynamic and often violent, and borders were changing. Everything was changing, and the technology was changing, and new weapons coming in and out, and all the mobility is just amazing. And so he was the one at that point to pull it all together.
So how was it that Custer led his people into such a horrific defeat when he was supposedly, I mean, I know you were saying it was a different kind of war and different kind of fighting, but some grave misjudgments occurred.
Yeah, well, you know, we sort of think of Custer as this big mythic figure striding through history doing whatever the heck he wants, but, you know, in actuality, he was a military officer, and even before this battle, and just in the months before, he had been told to testify before a Senate committee looking into corruption in the Grant administration, and he had fingered Grant's brother, Orville. Presidents always seem to have a brother that gets him into trouble for doing some illegal things with the Indian agencies. And this infuriated Grant, who stripped him of his command of the column. Older General Terry was officially in charge of things, and this meant that Custer was under a cloud. And as Terry would later say, Custer was looking to sort of clear his name and make one of his many comebacks. And so when his scouts sighted this turned out to be a huge Lakota and Cheyenne village of about 8,000 people on the dawn of June 25th, the terrain would make a huge factor in what would happen. They couldn't actually see the village. They could just see smoke and evidence of a pony herd, and it wouldn't be until they were right on it that they would actually see what they were dealing with. And by this time, Custer had committed his command into three different battalions. And by dividing his command, it enabled this huge group of warriors, or actually about 2,000 warriors, to defeat the regiment battalion by battalion. Custer in one battalion would be completely wiped out, and his two underlings, Major Marcus Reno and Captain Frederick Benteen, who would eventually unite and undergo a two-day siege before they were rescued by Terry, would suffer great losses, but there would be survivors.
The story of Custer's Last Stand is also, I mean, it's about the characters whom you describe in great detail, but it's also about the larger drama of United States policy toward Indians and, you know, the countless broken promises which we look back on. But what was U.S. policy toward Native people after the Civil War?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Grant began he would be a two-term president, and by 1876 it was nearing the end, and it was all a catastrophe. But he began with the greatest of intentions. He wanted to implement the Quaker policies of peace instead of war and all this kind of thing. But by 1876, Grant, this was proving powerless in the face of America's push for more. Gold had been discovered in the Black Hills of South Dakota today in an expedition led by Custer. A financial panic had gripped the country just the year before. The government owed $2 billion in debt, you know, it's a huge figure, and the best thing to do, they all knew, was to discover gold. So within months, 10,000 gold miners had flooded into the Black Hills, even though it was Lakota land. The town of Deadwood sprang up overnight, and the Grant administration decided that they had to force the Lakota to sell, who refused to. And so this campaign, which would culminate in the Battle of Little Bighorn, was a tawdry imperialistic war to bring the Lakota and Cheyenne into the reservations and force the sale of the Black Hills.
It seems like, you know, for all that during the time that we live in, we like to talk about accepting cultural diversity and things like that, it seems like it's just an absolutely irreconcilable cultural difference between the Indian ways of life, diverse as the various Indian cultures were, and the American way of life, because the American way of life was all about exploiting resources like furs and yep. as you say, gold, in order to accumulate wealth, while the Indian ways were really more about survival and a completely different relationship toward the land, and those two could not coexist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been called a clash of cultures. And, you know, and when you look at it that way, it seems inevitable, it's all going to happen, and to a certain degree that's true. I mean, what happened to the buffalo was as much a factor as anything, with railroads and other elements that would disrupt the area ecology, the buffalo population, the hunting of the buffalo, that population would crash, and the whole Lakota culture depended on the buffalo, and that would force them onto the reservation as much as any military victory or defeat. And I mean, those are two incompatible lifestyles. And you know, this is the story of our manifest destiny. And you know, and I say in the book, this is in many ways the battle of the Little Bighorn is not over, because this little different American's version of colonialism, where you know this kind of thing was happening in Africa and India and the Middle East, but this was happening within our own borders, and the legacy of this battle, is still with us today.
What do you think is the legacy of this battle?
Well, you know, I call the book "The Last Stand." From my perspective, you can't. Everyone knows of Custer's Last Stand, and you know, going down in a blaze of glory and winning eternal fame. But you know, this was a great Lakota Cheyenne victory, but it was in many ways the beginning of that culture's last stand. 14 years after Custer's death, Sitting Bull would die on the Standing Rock Sioux Agency when the superintendent of the reservation ordered his arrest, and Lakota police would shots would be fired when Lakota police tried to arrest Sitting Bull in the winter of 1890, and he, and along with several family members, would die. And so I think, you know, these two last stands are, you can't understand the one without the other. And, you know, the legacy that's occurred on reservations to this day, where conditions are inexcusable, really, given, you know, what's happening with the rest of the country, means that, you know, much of what happened in the 19th century has not really been addressed in a way that this nation can be proud of.
What do you think it tells us about U.S. incursions into, I mean, even Iraq in the, you know, 20th and 21st centuries?
Yeah, well, you know, it's as a, you know, it was a part of a global process in the 19th century, and it's a global process that's still going on today. And you know, we have a tendency to look at the myth of the last stand as sort of this, you know, particularly if you're a teenage male, it's very attractive. You know, go out there with your back to the wall and you know, win eternal fame, but. You know, I don't know what good that does for us in the 21st century. I was amazed to learn that when the first bullets were flying at the Battle of Little Bighorn, Sitting Bull's response was not to fight back, but to see if the soldiers might want to negotiate. He sent out his nephew One Bull with his shield and said, "See if they want to talk." You know, he was looking for a diplomatic way out of this. This battle did not have to happen. The soldiers, of course, were not willing to talk, and Sitting Bull had no alternative but to say, "Let's go at them." But I think, you know, that kind of alternative is more in keeping with what might be used to us today. You know, marshal your forces together, get as strong as you can, try to negotiate, but if that doesn't work, and there will be plenty of times a negotiation doesn't work, don't screw around, deal with it. And that's exactly what happened June 25, 26, in 1876.
We're talking to Nathaniel Philbrick, author of the book The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. History is written by the victors, as the cliche goes, but in this case, the victors of that battle were the ones who eventually suffered defeat, the Lakota people and the native people of that whole very vast region. What accounts do we have from the Indian point of view about this event?
Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible the amount of testimony we have about this battle. And actually, just the last decade or so, a huge amount of Native testimony has been published and or just come to light and is in archives all over the country. But, you know, some of this has to be used with caution because a lot of it was through interpreters. You know, it came through interpreters that had their own agendas. Sometimes the interviewers were Army officers and, you know, in the late 19th century, a warrior was more likely to tell an Army officer what he wanted to hear rather than what necessarily happened, given, you know, that they might suffer the consequences. But then there are transcripts of interviews conducted with some of Sitting Bull's descendants from that time, and there's a huge treasure trove of them at the University of Oklahoma, as well as archives all over the country, and then a lot of oral tradition that has been recorded quite recently, and so it comes from all over the place, and you know the battle was a confused battle. It was dusty, smoke all over the place, the black powder, and you know they the Lakota and Cheyenne didn't know who they were fighting initially. Custer had shaved his head, so he didn't look like the long hair of his. That everyone was expecting. So there will always be ambiguities and difficulties of evidence, but more and more keeps coming to light, and each generation will look at this battle and see it slightly differently.
This happened in 1876, as you were saying, the U.S. centennial, and right after the 4th of July is when the news broke. How did it affect Americans' self-image at that time?
Well, you know, this was America had been building to the centennial celebration for 100 years, pretty much, and there was a big exhibition in Philadelphia, and you know, the Civil War was finally behind the nation, and the West looked as if it had been finally won. You know, we were going to be a bi-coastal continent, and so America was feeling very good about itself in 1876, and then to hear just 3 days after the July 4th celebration that America's greatest Indian fighter had just been wiped out to a man, it was inconceivable for many people. And so, you know, people were saying, "What the heck happened?" And the cry of revenge went out. Congress voted through measures that never would have happened before, and the Army was able to redouble its efforts against the Lakota and Cheyenne. Forts were quickly built on what had been Lakota and Cheyenne land, and it all accelerated. And within a year and a half of the battle, just about every tribal chief and his people were on the reservations.
What new information did you find in your years of research that adds to our understanding of this event and of this time?
Well, you know, I think a battle of this complexity and given the ambiguity of the evidence, I don't think anyone's going to find that, you know, smoking gun. So this is what happened, and people have sort of tried to claim they found those things in the past. I don't make that claim. I mean, the one thing I did have access to was an unpublished manuscript written by the daughter of Private Peter Thompson, who should have died with Custer, but his horse gave out, so he followed on foot and claims to have seen Custer down by the Little Bighorn River all alone on his horse, Vic, just about a half hour before the the beginning of what would become Custer's Last Stand. And there's all sorts of issues with Thompson's account, which was written 38 years after the battle. And, you know, it's been dismissed, mocked by scholars. But what's interesting is in the last few decades, more and more seemingly outlandish details from his account have been corroborated by other accounts that have come to light. And what Thompson's daughter reveals is that he had begun keeping a notebook just months after the battle, so that when he finally published his account, it was based on these notes rather than simply the hazy recollections of an old man. And, you know, there, with every first-person account, there's issues. We are limited people, and in a battle, things are, even more hard to figure out what's happening. But I think this evidence, I use the Thompson account as a kind of way to dramatize the issue of evidence, of the complexities of knowing what happened in a battle as complicated and as disjointed as this. Because I think in many ways the evidence issue is as interesting as the chronology of the battle.
We're primed by movies and children's stories and things like this to see especially wars and battles as a battle of the good guys and the bad guys. Do you have any residue of that as a historian? Do you have to kind of fight that tendency?
Well, you know, I think all of us, no matter how objective we claim to be, have innate prejudices of one kind or another, or overcompensations of one kind or another, and you know, and that's why every generation sees it inevitably differently. We're not even aware of the prejudices sometimes we have, and so I mean, what I tried to do was to see it as to have as much sympathy for all sides as possible, and to sort of allow my telling of the battle to unfold. Of going back and forth from Lakota perspective to U.S. military perspective, and just sort of let it evolve organically from that. I didn't come at this saying, "Wow, Custer's been given a raw deal," or "Custer was a deranged maniac," or you know, anything like that. I was learning as I was going along, and and trying to let it evolve as it evolved in the telling, because. You know, this was a different time, totally, you know, in many cases, a different spiritual and a political time and cultural time, and I did my best to try to bring a sense of what it was like to be alive at that point and the difference of that to life. And, that's basically what I try to do with all my books.
What is this site like now where this battle took place?
Well, I've been to the battlefield now 5 times, and every time I go, it's as if I'm seeing it for the first time. It just packs such an emotional wallop. It's sort of a mini mountain range overlooking this wide valley of the Little Bighorn, where the Lakota and Cheyenne village was, and it's not heavily settled at all, and so that you get a sense of haunting spiritual space. Something bad happened here. You can just sort of feel it. And in many ways, it looks the way it did, but there are, of course, all these gravestones speckling the bluffs. It's a place, when I first went there, it was a very sort of impressionistic response. I've at one point ridden a horse over the battlefield and trying to get a handle on the topography and how the many ravines and gulches influence the outcome of the battle, but once again, every time I go back, I can feel its force.
I love that you rode a horse over it.
Yeah, I mean, it was the Crow tribal member Charlie Realbird was my guide, and I was on his former rodeo horse Tomcat. Luckily, he was 27 years old. I'm not much of a horseman, I'll tell you, but it was. What you realize when you do this is that the topography is so uneven and complex that you get swallowed up by it, so that even though it looks from a distance like you can pretty much see everything around you, and it's a very vast space. It's 6 miles from where Reno siege occurred to where Custer died on Last Stand Hill. And despite the sense of space, you get swallowed up in this topography. And so you can see how individual, very isolated micro theaters of combat occurred almost simultaneously without any kind of sort of interaction between the two. So, it was a very useful exercise.
Any big lessons that you drew from this that you didn't have before? Any way in which doing this project changed you?
Well, this was 4 years that were completely all involving. They aged me. completely immerse yourself in a new landscape, right in the very heart of America, was really just an era of my life I will never forget. I think it's, you know, when we kind of idealize our history and look to our founding fathers and the burst of ideological fervor that created America, but the fact of the matter is so much of our history is very bloody, violent, and not pretty at all. With this book and with my previous one, Mayflower, I really wanted to explore those kind of epic epicenters in the push across our continent that are still with us today and with legacies that are not necessarily something we can be completely proud of, but I love this country, and I think one of the more important parts about being an American is the ability to look back and try to see it in terms of what really happened, because that's the story that really matters.
Well, and that strain of living in peace and living among one another without bothering each other has also always been there. It's just that the greed one always seems to win out in the end.
Yes, and you know what? I mean, we can look from the future, looking back to the past with this, how could they do this, blah, blah, blah. But, when you're in a time caught up with those greed factors that you may not see as greed factors, let's call it self-interest, it blinds people to the repercussions. And it's only, once you're no longer personally involved that you can begin to say some of these things. But it's important. That's, I think, why history is important, because it makes you, teaches hopefully us humility that no one has ever been able to figure it out. And, history, the past was just as messy as it is today. And, no one's figured it out, and I don't think we ever will.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of the book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. And once again, he will be speaking tonight at the School for Advanced Research. It's at 6 o'clock, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Seating is limited, so you might want to call 505-986-0151 for reservations. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe today.
Well, thank you.